Thank you all for coming. This is our panel on digital protectionism. I was just handed a note on the way in that said, please, please, please remind people to go down to the cocktail hour after the end of our session. I thought, I don't think we're going to need to remind people to hit the bar, but you're strongly encouraged to do so after the panel. My name is Nancy Scola. I'm a technology journalist. Excuse me, I cover the intersection of technology and public policy. Again, this is our panel on digital protectionism. The topic here is sort of complex. The idea is that as U.S. tech companies sort of continue to dominate the Internet and there are growing concerns around the world about privacy and security, some countries have reacted by taking steps to sort of strengthen their own corner of the Internet, protect their sort of homegrown domestic Internet industries. And that's raising some concerns here in the U.S. and sort of around the world as well. So we're here to discuss this with our terrific panel. We have a great group. To my left is Ambassador Daniel Sepulveda. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy at the State Department, obviously. To his left is Ambassador Miriam Shapiro. We have two ambassadors in a row. That's a coup, I think. She's the Visiting Fellow in Global Economy and Development at Brookings and a former Deputy U.S. Trade Representative. To Miriam's left is Andrea Glorioso. Andrea is a counselor for digital agency at the European Union delegation to the United States. To Andrea's left is, let's check my notes here, Yael Weinman. Yael is vice president for global privacy policy and the general counsel at the Information Technology Industry Council, or ITI is probably better known in this room. And to Yael's left is David Chivern with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, where he is the Executive Vice President for the Center for Advanced Technology and Innovation. So the way this is going to work is each of our panelists are going to give some opening remarks, about 5-6 minutes, and then I may ask a question or two. And then we're going to throw it open to the floor, and we're really hoping to make this sort of a lively back-and-forth conversation with all of us. So if you can think of your questions as our speakers are going along, that would be great. So we're going to kick it off, and we have first is David to give a bit of an overview of the topic.
Great. Thank you very much, and I'm very pleased to be here. For those of you who don't know, the U.S. Chamber is the largest business federation in the world. When people ask me what we do, I say we do a lot of things, but fundamentally we tell the story that business is the answer, not the problem, that free enterprise is the answer, not the problem. And in particular, I was asked to establish at the Chamber something called the Center for Advanced Technology and Innovation to particularly talk about the policy choices that we have ahead of us that will either help a technological evolution and revolutions in the U.S. and the U.S. economy, or retard U.S. leadership in technology. And on a number of fronts, we have choices on both ends. Obviously, things like immigration reform, education reform, infrastructure investment are all issues that technology companies care deeply about, and where the right choices can help propel us forward and the wrong choices can help hold us back. But what many people may not know about the U.S. Chamber is that we have a very, we are globalists in perspective and have been for 102 years. Almost a quarter of our staff is in our international group, and we spend a lot of time talking about trade, free trade, open trade, trade is good, and international commercial relationships are not only prosperous but good for peace around the world. And in that regard, we have sort of a convergence of tasks, if you will, where I've been talking about technology and our international group has been talking a lot about fears, about protectionism broadly, but also in particular about, for want of a better term, Internet protectionism or protectionism in the digital realm. And I think, first, it's important to, as a sort of scene setter here, I think it's important to lay out that there are a couple of parallel concerns going on here, when you're talking about European activism in the area in particular. The first is, a concern shared by governments broadly, including the U.S. government, about how do you, as a nation state, what is your role in this thing called the Internet? All governments are wrestling with the borderless nature of the Internet in a world where jurisdiction and rights and responsibilities and all the things are defined by borders. And we have broadly gotten very used to this idea that the nation state is sort of the main building block of civilization, but not here it ain't. And as a matter of fact, I had a very close friend of mine who's a very, very senior former national security official. We were talking about this, and he was saying, you know, we absolutely need new international agreements to govern the Internet. The only thing is, I'm just not sure that nation states are the right counterparties to that agreement. What is their relevance in this borderless world? It's certainly some, and they can certainly cause problems, but aren't there now the growth of these other organizations that are really trans-global that have as much or more influence on what happens to the Internet than nation states do? So you have broadly, I think, a number of countries wrestling with what to do with this beast. The U.S. government, certainly the European governments, Brazil, China. I mean, we can go down the list. But it does put at question the role of states in our new economy. And then you have the particular European fears, I think, about, for want of a better term, cultural imperialism. You know, not only do the states in Europe not control the net like any other states don't, there are latent fears that they will ultimately be controlled by companies that aren't sympathetic to Europe or European points of view. Obviously, the big complaints today are about the U.S. Internet giants, the Googles and Amazons and we can go Yahoos and go down the list. But really, I think thoughtful people understand it doesn't stop there, and maybe it's the U.S. companies today and Chinese companies tomorrow. But in general, nobody's seeing a lot of European champions grow. And so there are these fears that this thing that's become central to their economies and the world economies will not have a European perspective. That's, I think, an additional gloss on the problem. And certainly there have been various attempts. I don't think they've necessarily been coordinated. I think they come out of a similar root of this fear of cultural imperialism. But whether it's the Google tax or the talk about a European cloud or data protectionism, antitrust complaints about Google, there was, you know, it was a great quote that, you know, the French government blocked a bid by Yahoo to take a controlling stake in Daily Motion. And French economy minister said, maybe if Europe protected itself much better, it would be much stronger against the United States. You know, I don't know what that has to do with Yahoo in particular. But the fact of the matter is it comes out of this angst. I would probably take the view, again, these aren't coordinated. I think they'd be more effective. And if they were coordinated, come from some central point of view. And I think it's certainly, if you look at the European experience, all of these things will, you know, vis-a-vis Europe, obviously fail, but not without pain. And if Europe becomes a blocking point on Internet progress, the Internet will channel itself around Europe like water in a stream around a rock. The consumers would be hurt, but most important, European companies would not have the financial or economic environment in which they could grow to be champions, and there's no reason there can't be European champions in this space. But if you're just talking about Europe itself, it can do things that are difficult and expensive and annoying, but I don't think it's going to change the history of the Internet. What could, though, is if other countries decide to get on the bandwagon. If China, Brazil, India, whatever, decide to follow the lead of their own sets of these nets that they're throwing over the Internet, for want of a better term, you're not only creating a lot more pain, you're eventually retarding the development of the digital realm itself. The sad thing is I always come back to Europe is where free enterprise was born. And if it wants to win in the Internet age, it should really go back and embrace those roots about innovation and free enterprise. Because what I'm afraid they'll do is spark a whole set of circumstances that will really retard all of those values that we holds so dear. And so with that, I will shut up and go down the list, and then we're happy to talk to you about whatever you'd like to talk
about. I'm sorry, David. I'm just going to jump in with one quick question. Can you define the European cloud for folks, just so we have some concrete example of
well,
what
there, I mean, I think that it comes down to this data indigenization arguments that data should be somehow physically kept in cloud, you know, an environment called the cloud that would stay in Europe somehow physically.
Okay.
You know, the cloud's a broad term for the storage devices located all across the world where our data goes and sits till we want it back. And there have been expressions of interest of those data places being in the physical confines of Europe.
Excellent. Thank you. Miriam?
Thank you. Nancy, I hope everyone can hear me all right. I'm getting over a little bit of laryngitis, but Danny's promised to hit me on the back if I start coughing. Delighted to be here and to have the chance to talk with all of you about this topic. As Yogi Berra once said, the future ain't what it used to be. And I think that's especially true when we talk about the digital economy. There are legitimate worries about a backlash against U.S. companies, but at the same time, it's neither helpful nor accurate to look at this as a U.S.-EU competition or as a zero-sum game. The Snowden disclosures obviously have created great distrust and heightened concerns that have already existed about whether the U.S. government and U.S. companies were taking privacy seriously, and that's trust that we need to figure out how to repair. At the same time, we're now seeing privacy concerns in Europe taking a back seat to greater fears about terrorism as a result of the tragedy in Paris, and this includes a desire to start tracking more closely certain individuals, and also to place limits on what can be said and done on the Internet. What's clear is that we need a thoughtful code of conduct for addressing the increasing tension between privacy concerns and between legitimate use of information by governments to protect us. Other concerns like unfair competition and tax avoidance are also focused more on U.S. companies than on other companies. Are these views exacerbated by the economic problems that Europe is now facing? Probably so. Are the allegations and the investigations really protectionist? It's hard to tell. But there are other measures that Europe has taken and is still taking that can favor EU companies that I think there are things we can do to address, and we can do those together. First, a bit of context. I think we have to try to change the perception that European technologists and innovators cannot compete fairly against those on the other side of the pond, on this side of the pond. It's simply not true. I think, and maybe I differ with David a little bit here, I think there are plenty of European champions. There was a study last year done that found that Europe, and it was Europe defined broadly, so it included countries that are outside of the EU, but they produced 30 technology companies worth more than $1 billion since 2000, while the U.S. produced 39. That's not a huge difference, and it turns out that in Europe, there was actually a higher hit rate or success rate than there was in the U.S. So I'm bullish on EU entrepreneurship, and if you want more specific examples, there was an excellent speech given by David Drummond, Google's legal officer in Lisbon at the council meeting last week that has lots of great examples of this spirit and European success. Further, the real competition for Europe is not coming from the United States, but from companies in Asia and other faster-growing regions. So think of Alibaba, for example. It's arguably the largest e-commerce company in the world right now, and it's certainly one of the most valuable companies today after its debut on the New York Stock Exchange. It wasn't long ago that the largest IT company in the world was Samsung. That was about 2 years ago. And companies like Tencent and other major players in the Chinese marketplace are on everyone's list of hot companies to watch for 2015. So that's a bit of context. I think we also need to ask, what can Europe do to create a more nurturing tech environment for entrepreneurship? And several factors come to mind. First of all, making the opportunity or the possibility of failure more readily acceptable. I'm always struck by how differently failure is seen in the United States than in Europe. In the U.S., it's okay to fail. You pick yourself back up and you try again. But in the EU, it's still a stigma. Given that difference in perception, almost surprising how many European tech companies do succeed. Another factor is ensuring that there are liquid capital markets that can help boost investment in startups. The decision last week by the European Central Bank to embrace quantitative easing can help in the tech sector if some of those funds find their way to these companies that are really hurting for capital. I also think Europe's determination now to truly create a digital single market will help so that all companies, U.S., EU, others, will not face as many conflicting rules and regulations from 28 different member states. I also think on the education front, Europe and also the U.S. Really have a long way to go in ensuring that they are equipping their students and future employees with the technology skills that are going to be needed to compete effectively in this century. So let me close with the third subject that I wanted to mention, and that's how do we help persuade the EU to resist the temptation of protectionism and embrace more open policies? I said at the beginning that I think there are a number of measures that can be taken. And I'm not suggesting these are important measures because of the U.S. interests here, but because of the European interests that are really at stake. So, for example, when it comes to regulation, how can Europe boost the level of transparency, the level of participation, and accountability so that when it is regulating, it's embracing more diverse views and it's only regulating where it really needs to? Nothing wrong with having very high standards, but again, looking at regulations as the U.S. has in terms of whether we need them, because there are some cases where we have overregulated in the past, and the Obama administration has taken a real hard look at what regulations are no longer useful, are no longer fostering entrepreneurship and innovation. It was actually Chancellor Merkel who said at Davos last week that the EU single market needs to become less regulated and more open. Now, an American can't say that, but a European can. And certainly the Chancellor of Germany saying that, I think, is a very powerful signal. And trying to open up the regulatory process is one objective of the transatlantic trade and investment negotiations that are now underway. So hopefully that will continue to be an important aspect of those discussions. Another way to resist the temptation of protectionism is to open up the EU standard-setting process. I'm sure many in this room have either attended or tried to attend European standard-setting exercises and know what an essentially still closed shop that process is. But again, it strikes me that it's in Europe's interest to open this process up more so that EU standards don't just become embraced in Europe, but they become global standards that working with the U.S. can, again, help both economies achieve a more level playing field and together compete more effectively against countries in Asia and other markets. So I think this would be an important step. And again, I hope that the TTIP negotiations underway will be able to address that issue. Another way is to embrace the free flow of cross-border data. It's certainly not a new idea. The EU has been supportive of this concept in the US-EU ICT trade principles that were embraced a couple years ago. So I think that's another area where both parties can work together to make sure that that principle is embraced, with, of course, protections for privacy concerns, as long as they're not, they don't become an excuse for discriminating against companies from the other party. The last measure that I'll mention briefly is something that David alluded to as well, and that's prohibiting the use of localization measures that would require that servers be located only in certain countries, or that would require the use of local products, local services, local intellectual property rights. The EU and the U.S., I think, see eye to eye on this issue much more than other countries do. So, again, the transatlantic trade negotiations are an opportunity for the U.S. and the EU to come together and embrace a clear standard that perhaps one day the rest of the world will also see the wisdom of agreeing to. So these are a few steps that I think can help EU companies compete more effectively against U.S. companies, but perhaps more importantly, help U.S. and EU companies compete together more effectively against companies in China and elsewhere. Keep in mind, as Chairman Ramirez said this morning, there are today 25 billion devices connected to the Internet. That number is expected to double in the next 2 years, and the majority of those will not be in the U.S., and they will not be in Europe. So those are a couple steps that I think can be taken. It's based on the concept that fair competition increases exactly the kind of innovation and discovery that creates the companies tomorrow. If only we knew, sitting here today, what those companies are.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. One quick question, and I can ask you maybe even a yes or no. When you say tech companies, European and U.S. tech companies are on equal footing, Internet companies fall under that umbrella wholly? They're on it as equal footing? The U.S. has no greater advantage when it comes to Internet-centric companies than tech companies in general? That doesn't make any sense, does it?
That's not what I said.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
I just wonder if there's a distinction between Internet-native companies and tech companies writ large. Maybe you can...
No, I was embracing Internet companies within technology.
Okay. Okay. Andrea?
Thank you. I'm going to get the microphone closed because there is somebody who is speaking very loud in the other room. So thanks for the opportunity. Thanks to the organizer. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. And I listen very carefully, and I will listen very carefully to the observation of my colleagues. I would like to offer a couple of perspectives on the European position on this discussion, and I will start straight away by saying that I would respectfully challenge even the title of this panel. I think that the term protectionism is an extremely loaded term, and we should be very, very careful to use it if we really want to have a discussion, if we really want to come to a common position. Now, if we're talking about international trade rules, there are very clear rules there that both the EU and its member states and the U.S. have agreed to in the WTO context, among others. And in that context, it is extremely clear that there are exceptions to the general rules of free trade in goods and services. Those exceptions include the cases of protection of privacy, of essential security interest, of public morals even, and both the U.S. and Europe and other countries which abide by those rules have used those exceptions. Now, to be very honest, I think it would be unhelpful for me to make a full list of U.S. measures which might, I'm not saying that are, which might be considered protectionist from a European point of view. I can make that list if that is helpful. But what I would rather like to point out is that it is a very clear principle in international trade that these exceptions are possible as long as they are not discriminatory, they are proportionate, and they are meant to achieve a legitimate public goal. Now, of course, if you ask me, I believe that our rules and the exception to the rules that we apply, to the international trade rules that we apply, meet all these three criteria. Now, it is perfectly fine that other countries and some other trade partners disagree with that. But the point is that we fought very hard to have an international trade system, to have a global trade system, and also in our bilateral relationship, we agreed that we would take concerns over exceptions, over whether those exceptions, the practical implementation of those exceptions to the general rule of free trade in goods and services are indeed proportionate and non-discriminatory and are meant to achieve a legitimate public goal. Now, I will be, I'm supposed to be a diplomat, but I'm not very diplomatic as a person. I'm really making an effort. I'm staying here in the U.S. I do not think that shouting around the word protectionism, as has been done in the past months, is helpful. Because if there really is a problem, then, and I'm not suggesting that anyone should do that, but if there really is a problem, then there are the venues to address those problems. If there is not a problem, what we are doing here is simply accusing each other of things that are undemonstrated, and we're poisoning the dialogue. I very much appreciate it, Miriam. I think you should be hired by the European Commission, actually, because I think you defended very well some of the points of view of the European Commission. I agree. We agree that, and the European Commission has made it very has made it crystal clear that we believe that the entrepreneurial environment in Europe can be much better than it is currently. And there are several reasons why that is not the case, including, I personally believe that the concept of the acceptance of failure in Europe is very, very low. And I think that's one of the main issues, and that is immediately apparent as soon as you get here in the U.S., as I did a few months back. That's something you see immediately. It's so apparent. And I think that has to change in Europe. That is very clear. Now, let me also make another observation, and this echoes what reinforces what Miriam said. We just reinforced the notion that you should be hired by the European Commission and help me in this job. It is a fact that many of what some in Europe call the over-the-top companies, the Google and the Facebook of this world, we could call them the internet service companies, they are U.S.-based. We are also seeing a very significant growth of similar kind of companies in Asia. I mean, if you look at the recent quotation of Alibaba and Tencent in China, that was quite striking. However, when we talk about the general technological environment, allow me here to be proud of my European heritage. We created Skype. We created Linux that is being used, is the operating system that is used in the widest possible sense across the world. Every single device, if you have an Android phone, you're using Linux. That technology has been developed in Europe. We developed MP3, which is the silly, stupid protocol, music format, that has allowed every music store, online music store in the world to succeed. So even though we accept a discussion on whether the entrepreneurial GSM, you know, I could make a full list, but again, I don't think, just like I don't think it's a point for me to make a list of measures in the U.S. which we believe are problematic, let's put it that way, and there are venues in which we are discussing those differences of opinion that we have. I simply wanted to point out that we are under, we do not have a complex of inferiority. I wanted to make it very clear. We know what we have produced. We know that we can succeed in this field. We know that, on the other hand, we are better off working together than continue to fight with one another. And this is why, allow me to insist again, let's stop for a moment to talk about protectionism, because there is no way, and I need to be very clear on this, there is no way that we in Europe are going to stop antitrust investigations against any player who has a 90% market dominance in Europe and we believe is abusing his dominant position. Now, in these investigations, those who are investigated have ample means, many means to demonstrate that that is not really the case. We had plenty of discussions on that. Those investigations are still continuing. Not for one single moment I heard the company being investigated claiming that our activities, meaning filing, formal filing, forget for a moment what people tell newspapers or tell the media, okay, that's part of the political game. But in filings, not for once has anybody claimed that our investigations were discriminatory or were less than completely abiding to the procedures that are followed. And by the way, the U.S. and EU procedures on antitrust are not that dissimilar. That has to be followed in these cases. Similarly, when we talk about privacy, you know, you have to accept, and I say this with a lot of respect for this beautiful country, but you have to understand that the notion of privacy and the level of understanding of what is the appropriate level of privacy protection in Europe is fundamentally different than in the U.S. I'm not saying it's better. I'm not saying it's worse. It is different. There was a Eurobarometer, one of the regular surveys that the European Commission runs across Europe to try and understand what people think about us. I usually don't like to read those surveys, but we try to understand what is important to European citizens in many different fields. And there was a very recent Eurobarometer survey in which a significant number of European citizens, not the majority, but a very significant number, highlighted that when they go online, their first and foremost concern is that their personal data is abused. After that, and long after that, comes that their financial data is abused. I don't think you would get the same result in this or in other countries. That is, again, doesn't mean that this system is better or that American people are right, are wrong, and we are right, but the notion is different. So when you see the way that Europe approaches the discussion on data protection and on privacy, you have to take this into account. Again, we do not believe, nor has any claim been, there has been no claim filed in the appropriate international trade dispute system, which has claimed that our rules existing or being discussed, our rules on privacy, are discriminatory, because they're not. Because, in fact, everybody laments our privacy rules. European companies and U.S. companies and Chinese companies, everybody laments about that. So as we say in Italy, if everybody is equally unhappy, you must be doing something right. Now, one thing that I the last thing that I would like to point out is we know very well, and I have a personal experience, that there have been, in the context of political discussions, tempers can run high. That is fine. It's not fine, but it happens. There have been words being flung around. There have been accusations, both from Europe to U.S. companies and from the U.S. to European companies or to European regulators. That is unfortunate. I don't think that should be the tone of the discussion. But certainly what's and I mention it only because it is mentioned by, I think it was you, Miriam, who mentioned the Snowden case, the discussion of the NSA, that is something of which I do not wish in this context to discuss, to enter into too much of a discussion. But what I will point out is that you cannot expect, if you have, and I will make just an example of this one company, but it could be applied to many other companies from Silicon Valley. If you have sold yourself and your services under the motto, don't be evil, and then something that what has happened happens, you cannot be surprised if there is a reaction, if people then say, well, you have not been totally honest with us. And what I'm trying to point at here is that rather than using terms such as protectionism, which, again, really, you know, they really irk us when we're accused of being protectionist. I'm sure that would irk the U.S. if we accuse you of being protectionist. Rather than use those terms, we should really try to be as honest and transparent and open to dialogue as possible, because at the end of the day, we are, and we are demonstrating that by investing a lot, both sides of the Atlantic, into TTIP, into the discussions on the trade and investment partnership, EU-US trade talks. That is taking a lot of time. There are colleagues from the U.S. trade team who can agree with me that that takes a lot of efforts on both sides. We are doing that because we believe in Europe and in the U.S., we believe that we are better off together, not against the rest of the world, but in a world that is changing, which competition is becoming global. And frankly, accusations of protectionism, which are not, at the end of the day, backed by real data, and I hear a lot about accusations of European cloud, people still have to show me where in European law there is something such as what people are fearing. Fears are one thing, and what is in the law is another. The law in Europe is very clear. Data can flow to the U.S. Without any problem as long as certain conditions are met. Until now, those conditions are met. You know very well that we are in discussion because we believe that the Safe Harbor Agreement can be made better and stronger. Those discussions are ongoing. I think they're perfectly legitimate discussions. But for the time being, I do not see in the text of the law, nor being debated, measures that would amount to what people are accusing Europe.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Let's just jump ahead. Yeah?
Thank you. I won't spend my few minutes focusing on the EU, mostly because I want to give you a little break, and maybe I'll apply for that job at the European Commission as well. So I'm going to focus a little bit more on the rest of the world. And, you know, the title of this panel, whether we think we should change it or not, is are U.S. companies overseas facing a backlash? And if we want to give a yes or no answer to that question, I would probably phrase the question a little bit differently. Are U.S. companies overseas facing challenges? And the answer to that is yes. But the answer to that is not only for U.S. companies. It's, I think, all companies in the tech sector. And the point that my organization tries to make is that some of these policies are harmful not just to U.S. companies, not just to the sector, but industry-wide. So that's an initial statement, and now I'll take a step back. I love that Miriam started with Yogi Berra. I thought you were going to say it's deja vu all over again, but I think that's appropriate here, too, because when I started at the Federal Trade Commission in 2002, it was just on the heels of the first safe harbor negotiation, and here we are again with a renegotiation of safe harbor, and many of the same issues come to bear there. But I think the real question we're asking ourselves, is it different now? How is the backlash or the challenges, are they different now? And there's no question that the Snowden revelations made things feel a little bit different now because there are other equities at stake, other things that governments are pointing to as rationales for their policies.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Can you just define safe harbor for folks, make sure that they know it?
Oh, boy, sure.
Three words or less.
About 7 years of my life on safe harbor, so and continue to spend more. So as Andrea said, the EU has a different approach to privacy from the United States, not necessarily better, just different. However, the EU has a restriction on cross-border data transfers that only companies that have an adequate level of protection can receive data from the EU. And sadly, the U.S. has not been deemed to have adequate privacy protection because of the framework that we have, and that was a European Commission decision. And we can talk about that another time. So there's a workaround that was developed in 2000. The safe harbor is not an agreement. It's not a treaty ratified by Congress. It's called the safe harbor framework. And it's what companies affirmatively agree to abide by a certain set of principles that are administered by the Department of Commerce. And there's a Department of Commerce rep right over there if you have follow-up questions. Brian Larkin in the office that administers safe harbor. So companies make these.
You raise your hand, make sure that.
It wasn't a very enthusiastic thing.
So companies make these commitments, and then those companies are deemed safe. Thus the safe harbor. And then data can flow from the EU to those companies. And the safe harbor framework is what has an adequacy determination. So I hope that explains it for those who don't live and breathe safe harbor. So again, how does this feel different? The safe harbor renegotiation now does feel a little bit different because of the different climate. We're not just talking about the commercial sector, but we're also talking about government access to data. So I think that resonates all these policies. So I know we want to leave time for robust questions. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what we're seeing in other countries that are quite problematic. And Miriam touched upon this, data localization, and David touched on it as well. We're talking about server requirements. Countries are requiring that companies store data on site in country, which for obvious reasons can be very inefficient and can lead to inefficiencies that in many ways don't solve the problem that the country is trying to address. So if a company leaves a market, you haven't accomplished anything. You might require that they store data, but if they're not there anymore, then what have you accomplished? You haven't led to any type of economic growth. So server localization, local content, requiring that companies partner with local companies, these are all examples that make doing business a lot more difficult. And we're seeing these types of measures in Russia, in Nigeria, in Indonesia, in China. We almost saw it in Brazil with the Marco Civil legislation. There had been a data storage requirement in there that was pulled out at the last minute. And I will say that this is not just a U.S. company or U.S. tech sector issue. You're seeing local trade associations on the ground talking to their own governments, saying these are problematic policies for our own businesses, for our own local businesses. And the best example of that is in Brazil, where the local trade association said, this is bad policy. This is bad policy for local industry. And you see that in Russia as well, where the local companies, the Russian airlines, said, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to comply with this law. So I think we need to change the narrative a little bit. You know, is the tech sector facing challenges overseas? We can find a better phrase from digital protectionism, but I think the conversation is the same.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
You need a microphone.
This one. Thank you very much. Thanks to all the panelists, and thanks to all of y'all for being out here this late in the day. I know you've sat through a number of panels, and I appreciate you sticking this one out. I'd like to associate myself particularly with the comments of Ambassador Shapiro. They pretty much articulate what the U.S. position is on these questions, so I don't really have to reiterate that. And also with Yael on the points relative to protectionism as it's actually manifesting itself in multiple markets around the world that are outside of Europe. And for the purposes of balance, I want to point out that in our international negotiations, when I'm at the International Telecommunications Union or at the OECD or at Net Mundial or at any other forum, I can tell you that right now that we have no better ally, no better friend than Europe. Consistently and with both discipline and information, our European colleagues are able to manifest very strong arguments against what have been very bad proposals in a number of fora and with which we work with them hand in glove. There are significantly more that unites the United States and Europe on all of these questions than there is that divides us. All of that said, friends can and do disagree from time to time. Whether or not you want to label any given policy protectionist is a term that should be used very carefully. We can disagree, and I think we do, relative to the current construction of the proposals for the Privacy Directive and regulation being constructed out of Europe, as to whether or not it's good policy without declaring it protectionist. We can also disagree relative to whether or not data localization initiatives or requirements for a European cloud, for example, are protectionist. They may very well be intended to be rooted in other public policy values. But what we can bring to the table and argue and have argued and will continue to argue is that data localization requirements or the imposition of technical mandates for reasons other than those that are voluntary and chosen by the market are generally bad public policy and will not solve the underlying problem.